All right, first matter, on calendar this morning, Sherman versus State. Counsel, are we ready?
I am, Your Honor.
All right. Would you like to reserve any time?
I would, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve, 3 minutes if I can for rebuttal. May it please the court, my name is David Anthony. I represent the appellant, Donald William Sherman, in this appeal. The one thing that the parties agree on, and the one thing that the district court did that was proper, was the district court invalidated two of the aggravating circumstances that were found by the jury at Mr. Sherman's penalty hearing. Specifically, the court found that the robbery and the burglary aggravating circumstances were invalid under this court's decision in the McConnell case. After removing those two aggravating circumstances, we're left with two statutory aggravators that this court needs to reweigh against all of the substantial and compelling mitigation evidence that was presented at Mr. Sherman's penalty hearing. It's our position that when you have substantial mitigation evidence that's presented at a penalty hearing, that the state is simply not able to meet its heavy burden of proof to prove that the invalid aggravating circumstances were harmless.
Well, let's talk about the elephant in the room, the prior murder. How do we reweigh and how do we not reweigh in favor of the death penalty when you have a prior murder?
I think there's two...
I mean, you know the makeup of this court.
That's correct, Your Honor. I think there are two ways to look at that. First of all, we need to look at the extent to which the prior murder was itself mitigated by the defense's evidentiary presentation at the penalty hearing. At the penalty hearing, the defense presented the testimony of the prosecutor who prosecuted the prior murder, who testified that the facts showed that there was a felony murder, that the victim who was killed in a grocery store was killed when shots were fired in a panic, that the victim reached for the perpetrator, and that the killing was accidental. So on the one hand, there's the fact that the offense itself was mitigated by the prosecutor who testified on behalf of the defense. The second reason that I think that the prior murder is mitigated is based on our allegations that the state failed to disclose material and exculpatory and impeachment information that would have further mitigated the weight to be given to the prior murder aggravating circumstance. One of the, as far as what wasn't disclosed, we've alleged in the present petition that the state has in their possession the files from the Sandpoint Police Department. The state has never disputed that those files are in fact in their possession. The Sandpoint Police Department files show that there was substantial forensic testing that was done on the physical pieces of evidence that were gathered from the crime scene. The way that the state presented the prior murder was to argue that Mr. Sherman was the principal in the offense and that the co-defendant was merely a getaway driver. The evidence that would have been revealed from the Sandpoint Police Department's file would have shown that the co-defendant was actually in the grocery store at the time of the murder. The testing of the forensic items showed that glass from the grocery store was found on the co-defendant's shoes and on his shirt. There was also testing that was done by the police department regarding the size of the latent shoe prints that were found at the crime scene. And the latent shoe prints were found to be a size 8 shoe print, and whereas Mr. Sherman wears a size 10 shoe print. When they arrested the co-defendant, he was caught wearing size 8 shoes. So to answer the court's question about the prior murder, I would argue both that it was mitigated by the testimony of the prosecutor who testified at the penalty hearing, and secondly, that it would have been mitigated by evidence that was within the state's actual possession that they failed to disclose that would have shown that the co-defendant had substantially more culpability than the evidentiary presentation that was made at trial in the absence of disclosure of that evidence. Now, I know that in the past, I know that this court is aware of arguments that are made by defense counsel about this court's ability to act as an appellate sentencer when it reweighs a death sentence. Unlike a jury, if a jury was hearing this case today on a resentencing, they would have to look the defendant in the eye, they would have to hear the sound of his voice, they would be permitted to consider mercy in their deliberations, and they would also receive a jury instruction that tells them that they don't need to impose the death penalty under any set of circumstances, including the complete absence of mitigation. And I would respectfully submit that this court, on an appeal, simply can't replicate the dynamic that exists before a jury if the jury was doing a resentencing today. In addition, we would argue that there are specific reasons why the court cannot reweigh the death sentence in this case. Specifically, this court found substantial constitutional violations on direct appeal and also on the post-conviction appeal. On direct appeal, this court found that there was improperly admitted evidence of the victim impact of the prior murder offense, and the court held that that evidence should not have been admitted at the penalty hearing. The court also addressed a claim of prosecutorial misconduct, where the prosecutor got up and he argued that Mr. Sherman should be executed to prevent the execution of future victims. This court held on direct appeal that those comments went beyond permissible argument, and it characterized the arguments as extremely inflammatory and improper. On the previous post-conviction appeal, this court was also presented with, through an ineffective assistance claim, with comments that were made by the judge during voir dire, where he told the jurors that the death penalty was the normal sanction for murder as provided in the Old Testament of the Christian Bible. And he referred them specifically to the Book of Judges and explained that the Book of Judges sanctioned the death penalty as the sanction for murder. It's our contention that the court, when it's conducting a reweighing under McConnell, that the court needs to consider the cumulative impact of the various constitutional violations that the court has previously found on direct appeal and on the post-conviction appeal. The problem with the district court's decision is that there's no indication that the court ever provided that type of cumulative consideration of the cumulative effect of the various constitutional errors that have occurred in this case. One of them in particular is the argument about the state's failure to disclose material, exculpatory, and impeachment evidence. Now, I touched on that just a moment ago when I spoke about the state's presentation of the prior murder statutory aggravating circumstance. But there was also a plethora of other evidence that the state failed to disclose that they have never controverted. First of all, there was evidence that wasn't disclosed that would have disputed or negated the motivation for the offense. The state's evidentiary presentation at trial was that Mr. Sherman committed this murder to get revenge against his ex-girlfriend for breaking off her relationship with Mr. Sherman. The defense, however, was precluded from offering evidence that the ex-girlfriend spoke badly about her father, that she spoke about killing him to obtain his inheritance, and that she played off of Mr. Sherman's hypersensitivity to sexual abuse by telling him that she'd been sexually abused as a child by her father. It's our contention that the defense should have been allowed to present that evidence to the jury, particularly when we talk about whether a jury is going to sentence someone to life or death. That information about what the motivation for the crime was is very important. It's our contention that the district court or the trial court that heard this case was not in a position to reliably determine whether that evidence should have been admitted or excluded due to the fact that the state failed to disclose evidence that would have supported Mr. Sherman's defense. Specifically, in the instant petition, we've included records from the Longview Police Department. They cooperated extensively with the police department here as far as interviewing witnesses and collecting records. If that case file would have been disclosed, it would have contained information showing that the ex-girlfriend, Diane Bauer, solicited Mr. Sherman to kill her father before he could change his will to remove her from inheriting from him. That argument also dovetails into the argument about the trial court not performing a proper in-camera review before trial of the trust documents and the associated notes, which if they would have been disclosed, would have shown that the victim, Lester Bauer, was making arrangements 1 month before his death to exclude Diane Bauer from obtaining an inheritance from him based upon the fact that she'd been stealing money from him.
Evidence against Mr. Sherman kind of overwhelming, though? He confessed to a couple people. He stole the victim's credit cards, and he was caught with that afterwards and all that. To me, this is it's collateral here. I mean, the jury heard all that evidence, and it's how do you get around that on the prejudice issue?
Your Honor, the way that we would get around that is the defense never contested the fact that Mr. Sherman committed this murder. And we agree that there is overwhelming evidence that he committed the murder. The only relevant dispute between the parties at trial was his degree of culpability. Did he do this to get revenge against the girlfriend, or did he do it because she solicited him to do it and duped him into doing it by playing off of his hypersensitivity to this issue about sexual abuse? And so, to answer the court's question, it's not whether he committed the murder. The only real dispute between the parties is this level of culpability. And we would argue that, especially in the penalty phase, and we're talking about a jury and why they would send someone to death, certainly the prosecution's theory of motive is certainly much more aggravating than what we argue could have been presented if the state would have complied with their Brady obligations.
Mr. Anthony, do you have a record cite to the statement in the Longview Police Department records showing that Diane had solicited Sherman to kill Dr. Bauer?
I do, Your Honor. The site is volume 15A of Appellant's Appendix at pages 3761 to 3762. And that contains reference to a phone message from an individual who contacted the police to warn them that Diane Bauer had solicited Mr. Sherman to kill her father before he could change his will to exclude her from obtaining an inheritance from him. Very briefly, I don't have time to get into it, but there's also substantial Brady evidence that we argue was withheld regarding a solicitation to commit murder that was admitted against Mr. Sherman at the penalty hearing. The evidence that wasn't disclosed would have shown that the state procured the dismissal of a 90-day contempt of court sentence against the primary jailhouse informant. They also failed to disclose evidence that the other jailhouse informant was a paid informant for Metro and that she did undercover controlled drug buys for the narcotics division of the Metropolitan Police Department. It's our contention that the court needs to consider all of this evidence cumulatively, and if it's considered together, we submit that the court simply can't find harmless error in this case from the invalid aggravating circumstances. And if there are no more questions right now, I'll reserve my remaining time.
Thank you. All right. Thank you, Mr. Anthony. Mr. Owens?
May it please the court, I'm Steve Owens of the Clark County District Attorney's Office here on behalf of Respondent State of Nevada. Looking at McConnell, they raised this almost a year, a little bit under, after the McConnell case was published. The court has struggled over the years since then. I think that was late 2004. The court has struggled with applying this and articulating the harmless error standard and how you go about doing this. I would submit that in the majority of cases, the McConnell error has been found harmless. There have been a few that the court has reversed, most notably in unpublished opinions. And I would submit for other reasons, such as that it was a three-judge panel that imposed the death sentence, there are other factors at play. I've always been of a mind that the McConnell error, unless it is striking all of the aggravators, should be per se harmless. And that is because the felony aggravators are part and parcel of the crime itself that was introduced during the guilt phase. There was no additional evidence of the burglary and the robbery submitted in the penalty hearing. In the penalty hearing, what the jury heard about was this prior murder in Idaho, where Sherman had done, I think it was 11 years, and then been prematurely paroled, arguably. We certainly made that argument that he should not have been paroled. He was paroled, came down here and committed another murder, and then as a non-statutory aggravating circumstances, they heard that he was planning an escape and yet another murder of a couple corrections officers. officers and one of the witnesses that he had met in the jail. So this is a man bent on murdering and eliminating people. I submit those are very strong aggravators. He was on parole for that Idaho murder at the time. The mitigation that the jury found, that he was under the influence of extreme mental or emotional disturbance and under duress or domination of another, I think that has to be Diane Bauer and the drug use. That's what the defense argued in mitigation, that Diane Bauer was pulling his strings and kind of orchestrating this murder of her father. Frankly, I just don't see that that matters at all. Stu Bell was the prosecutor in this case, and he made a very compelling argument in the mitigation, closing of the aggravation case, closing the penalty hearing. He said that, look, in the Idaho murder, they're blaming it on the co-defendant, Herniak, who is much more sophisticated. They're suggesting Herniak put Sherman up to that murder. Well, here in Nevada, we have the Lester Bauer murder. Again, they're arguing that Diane Bauer is the one that put him up to that and orchestrated things, and that he was under her duress. And then we've got this conspiracy to murder or solicitation of murder and escape from the jail. And again, they're blaming the witnesses, Christine Coulter. They're blaming her, saying this was her. She's putting words in his mouth, putting ideas in his mouth. There's always somebody else motivating him to do these murders. We made that argument. Although the jury did find two mitigation factors and this third other mitigating circumstances, we don't know what exactly they were considering there. We don't know the weight that they placed on any of those mitigation factors. We don't know how many of the jurors found these particular mitigation factors. But we do know that they did not buy the argument that this argument of defendant being manipulated by others, that that somehow would rescue him from the death penalty. I think we have a prior murderer out on parole who commits another murder. That is just so compelling. There's going to be very little in mitigation that is going to be able to overcome that. And certainly I don't think that a McConnell-type error where we're simply removing two felony aggravators, which in the Ripple case, this court said that felony aggravators that arise out of the nature of the murder itself have the effect of just one aggravating circumstance. Removing that, I don't think that undermines at all the state's case in aggravation. It doesn't change at all the evidence that the jury heard in the penalty hearing. What we simply have is an instructional error that they were not should not have considered the burglary and the robbery in the weighing process. And that's a very subjective process, and I understand the court's difficulty in trying to determine what a jury would or would not have done, but I again submit that the nature of McConnell and the facts of this case, I think Judge Vega below was correct in finding that it wouldn't have made a difference, that we can still say beyond a reasonable doubt the jury still would have imposed the death here. Let me turn to the Brady allegations.
Before you do that, Mr. Yes. Owens, you began your argument by recounting this court's jurisprudence, either published or unpublished, in response to the McConnell case, and suggesting that the court should revisit or at least visit its reweighing jurisprudence when McConnell is implicated by concluding that McConnell is per se harmless. How would you structure such a argument in an opinion?
Well, I've made that argument all along in McConnell itself. In the amicus brief, I made that argument recently to this court. I can't remember the name of the case, but I focused on the aggravation phase of the penalty hearing in a bifurcated hearing and said where it doesn't affect the aggravators of the weighing and it only took place in the selection phase, that also wouldn't matter. I've made the argument all the way along, but we're kind of in uncharted territory. I don't know exactly how, other than what I've said previously to this court and in my briefs, that I think the focus should be on the evidence that the jury heard in penalty hearing. I don't think they place that much stock, and we give them too much credit for going through these elaborate jury instructions and that they're step by step. I know we have to assume that they follow the jury instructions. I think the practical reality is that once a death case, always a death case. And that's why when we have reversals and we come back, 9 times out of 10, we get death again. Even though the law may change, even though the aggravators may change, if the jury still hears the same evidence, chances are they're going to find death again. Now, that's certainly not for sure, and there's jurors out there that may view the evidence slightly differently. But that is more the analysis I would look at, is the actual type of evidence that the jury heard. And McConnell is an instructional error, not an evidentiary error. It's not an error where the jury improperly heard evidence that it was not allowed to hear. We're looking at whether or not they considered the burglary and robbery aggravating circumstances in the weighing equation. We know they could consider it in the selection decision, but in an unbifurcated hearing, you know, we don't know what the jury's thought process was, and I understand this court's jurisprudence that the death eligibility occurs after we prove the existence of an aggravator beyond a reasonable doubt and the weighing. And it's that subjective weighing that I just don't think that we can go in and say that that this McConnell error is going to be harmful simply because you're viewing it now and that it removes two aggravators. Well, it removed two that really didn't matter, that weren't part of the penalty phase itself. They were part of the guilt phase.
But when you're arguing these cases as a defense attorney, aggravators matter. And how do you balance what you've said about automatic harmless error when we have these cases where there's numerous aggravating circumstances, no mitigating circumstances, and a person gets life without or life with? I mean, how do you balance that? I mean, that happens. That happens.
Sure, that happens, and that's not a McConnell error. That's simply a jury deciding that the facts of a particular case don't warrant the death penalty. We certainly have that. But once they find that the facts of a case warrant the death penalty, I don't think us altering the law or altering the jury instructions is typically going to alter that jury's determination that death is warranted based on those facts.
But when you argue mitigation, it's important as a defense attorney that there be only two aggravating circumstances rather than four in a case like this. Now, I admit that, again, that elephant in the room makes this case a little different.
Right,
with the prior murder.
Well, and the case law says they're not to consider the strict number of aggravators, where you can have a whole bunch. You have to look at the aggravation and the mitigation, the facts of the case. So you can have a whole lot of very minor, unpersuasive aggravators that just don't weigh a whole lot, and you can have one mitigator that weighs hugely in a jury's mind. So again, looking at the facts of the case, I don't see that they changed here at all, and so I don't think the outcome would be any different. Please let me move on to Brady, the allegations there. We have, in looking back to the allegations that are made, the defense does not allege when they supposedly found some of this material. They don't give us information about when they found it or how they found it. They just throw out this bare allegation that, aha, you've been hiding this all along. The Sandpoint file, having to do with the Idaho murder, if you look at their record, they refer back to a declaration from Philip Robinson, who was the prosecutor in the Idaho murder. Incidentally, he was a witness for the defense. He testified for them in their mitigation case, and he mitigated that murder crime and said it really wasn't all that it was hyped up to be, and there's substantial mitigating facts. They're now citing to an affidavit from Philip Robinson. They don't say when they talked to him, and they could have talked to him at any time. And this declaration from Philip Robinson simply says, well, because I was cross-examined regarding evidence in the case, I know that the state must have had the Sandpoint, Idaho police file. That's where they're getting this claim that we had the police file. He doesn't know whether they had it or not. It's based on his cross-examination. He certainly doesn't know whether the defense attorneys had it. Well, if you look at the penalty phase evidence, we know that the defense was also in possession of at least the coroner's report from that Idaho murder, because they cross-examined and impeached one of our witnesses with the coroner's report having to do with tattooing. We had alleged that there wasn't tattooing on the body, and Nancy Lemke came forward with a document after the Sandpoint police file. So both parties were cross-examining, and the record shows both of them had documents from the Sandpoint police file. It's a bare allegation for them to claim that we somehow withheld it, that the Sandpoint police department, that this was some sort of joint investigation. They were witnesses in the case for both. We used the investigator, they used the prosecutor, and they both came in and testified for the jury talking about this Idaho murder. So they haven't shown that they timely raised this claim once they became aware of it. They haven't shown that anything was withheld from them. They haven't shown that the state somehow was in possession of this when they were not. In fact, the record would show otherwise. They haven't shown that it that there was some sort of agency relationship. That's what I'm getting at. Just because there's another police department doesn't mean we're charged with constructive knowledge of everything that they have. Only where there's a joint investigation is that agency relationship there, so that we are charged with knowledge of everything that they have in their files. They didn't investigate this murder case, at Sandpoint, the Idaho Police Department, so we're not charged with their documents. They had equal access to it, and it's a fatal flaw for them to make a Brady claim. Brady claims, I understand, they explain some of the delay if we truly withheld information, and we're the cause of why they couldn't raise a claim previously. But when they discover the basis for some alleged Brady claim, and then they sit on their rights in federal court, which they did here, then they haven't shown good cause for that delay. I would point out that this second petition was raised 7 years after the case was affirmed on direct appeal. It was raised 5 years after the first state post-conviction proceedings were concluded, and it was raised 3.5 years after the order of affirmance of the first state post-conviction proceedings. Immediately after that order of affirmance, they went to federal court, and they filed a petition on October 11, 2002, and then they sat in there for 3.5 years before returning to state court. The district court judge below cited the Judge Vegas cited the Coley case and said that pursuit of federal remedies does not constitute good cause for you sleeping on your rights over there before you return to state court. The Sandpoint file is just one example. I don't know if I'm going to have time to get to all of them. The Longview police reports, again, they didn't make an allegation about when they discovered them. I've looked through them. I don't see anything in there about them showing that Diane somehow was to be excluded from her inheritance. Rather, I think that comes from a transcript from a civil case held a year later when Diane Bauer and Bruce Bauer sued the Idaho Department of Corrections for releasing this murderer on parole prematurely, who then went and killed their father. I think that's where they got it, and they don't tell us how they got that transcript. It's certainly not Brady material. It's in a civil case after the conclusion of the criminal case. They don't tell us how long they've been in possession of that, sitting on the rights. Even if it were somehow in the Longview police report, and if there is some phone message, I don't think that phone message is going to show the content that the federal public defender represents, that somehow that there was this inheritance issue going on. They haven't shown some sort of agency relationship with Longview, and according to their own records, I found in there a letter between them and Longview where they had requested the records from Longview if they did not already have them in January of 2004 and received them in February of 2004. So we've still got them, and I shouldn't have to go hunting for this. This should be an affirmative allegation that they make, that we came into possession of these documents on such and such a date, and now we are timely returning to state court. Well, right there, we've got them waiting about 2 years before they return with this information supposedly in the Longview police reports. As to Plasencia, the informant in the jail and this solicitation to commit murder, they claim that we somehow got him released from some sort of 90-day sentence on a misdemeanor. They found that in the public records and the Justice Court record files. I've reviewed those. Nowhere in there does it say that Plasencia was released from his 90 days. They show that the detective tried to get him released, and Judge Lippis refused, and then there's a note that the prosecutor will have to work this out. But I didn't see anything in his documents at all about him somehow being not doing his full 90 days. And that was brought out at trial during testimony, not from Plasencia, because he was not a witness in the case. Again, there's marginal relevance here in terms of materiality for impeachment purposes. He didn't testify in the case, and there was information that he had wanted an early release from that 90 days, but no information even in their current documents that he actually got it. I'm out of time, and there's many more allegations. I think if you go back and look in the record, their allegations in their brief are not supported by the documents that they are citing to. They have exaggerated the claims. They have stated things that are not shown in their reports. And they have not made the allegation of when they came into possession of those so that we can make an assessment of whether there's good cause for them timely returning to state court.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Owens. Colleagues, any questions?
If I could just have him, he was on the informants. It was a second informant that was talked about in terms of the failure to disclose that he'd been a prior informant on drug deals or?
Christine Coulter. If you go back, they claim that, and I read that transcript, Christine Coulter was charged with a murder, and in that testimony it came out that one of the police officers testified that she was an informant for the police department in some sort of drug transaction that she was paid. She was not a paid informant in this particular case. My argument all along with Placencia, Coulter, and Stacey Mayer, who's in the briefs that they didn't mention here in oral argument, is that none of these witnesses were so critical here. They were all corroborated by the defendant's own handwritten note about the solicitation for murder. By the Placencia wore a wiretap, a wire device. So we have Sherman's own words about wanting to solicit the murder of these two corrections officers and Christine Coulter. We have other witnesses in the case and the defendant's own admissions that corroborate what they say. So if there was this information about Coulter being a paid informant previously in other cases, to the extent that that was withheld from them, not disclosed to them, it would have done them very little good, because the core of Coulter's testimony that there was a solicitation to commit murder is corroborated by the defendant's own words, and just would not have made a difference. And so that's the materiality there is just not sufficient to warrant relief on.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Holmes. Okay. Mr. Anthony, got a couple minutes left.
Thank you, Your Honor. Very briefly, I'd like to address the argument that Mr. Owens made that the violation was harmless because there would have been no additional evidence. If this argument sounds familiar, it's because it is familiar. We had this very same argument back in 2006. The court addressed that argument. It ruled in the Bejarano case and also in the Ripo case that aggravating circumstances are not merely a label, but they're a distinct part of the process. They're part of the eligibility phase where the statutory aggravating circumstances are weighed against all of the mitigation. And that's where the harmful error occurs in the McConnell case. And they're not just merely an improper label. I'd also cite the court to Justice Hardesty's concurring opinion in the Hart case, where we acknowledged that stare decisis and those principles meant that since other defendants have been able to rely on the McConnell issue, that Mr. Sherman should have the same right to rely on the court's precedents as well. I'd like to address very briefly the arguments raised by Mr. Owens about the timing of the discovery of these documents. One of the most important things to recognize is this is an argument that seems to have been raised for the very first time on this appeal. It doesn't seem to be an argument that was raised below. It was not a basis for the court's decision. The court rejected this claim on the grounds that the violation was not material. This argument about when documents were discovered is being put before the court during our oral argument for the first time. If I would have had an opportunity to get notice of that argument, I could have explained the dates when I discovered the various pieces of evidence. And I did go through in my reply brief and try to address when some of those documents were discovered. For example, with the jailhouse informant, I was able to get a certified copy of those records from Judge Lippis in March of 2005. I filed this petition in December of 2005, so well within 1 year of completing this Brady investigation, which is quite substantial, I filed this petition. I didn't do this to avoid state court in favor of federal court. I timely filed to have the claims heard here in the first instance, so if I had been given notice and an opportunity, I could have explained that under a totality of the circumstances, I was diligent, and Brady requires that these things be considered cumulatively by this court. And if there are no more questions.
Actually, I have one. Assuming, setting aside the timing question, you made reference to the Longview Police Department record, and I'd asked you where it was located.
Yes.
And that's part of the Brady violation argument here. Assuming that document were presented in reweighing, wouldn't that just solidify the mitigator that was found by the jury that Sherman was operating under the influence of someone else?
I think that what it shows is that the jury would have been extremely receptive to the evidence, because at trial all the evidence was excluded, and the only evidence that was offered were Mr. Sherman's self-serving statements. And this court said on direct appeal It dismissed those by saying, those are self-serving statements made by the defendant. Of course he'd say something to get himself a lesser level of culpability. The problem that we have is with the suppressed evidence and the evidence that defense counsel wasn't allowed to permit, it shows that the jury would have been receptive to the actual evidence itself. And that's our argument about why it was harmful as opposed to why it should be considered harmless. Because if the jury found the domination mitigator in the absence of any information except for the defendant's self-serving statements, who knows what they would have done if they were presented with actual evidence of all these statements that she was making in his presence in front of other people about being abused by her father. And we'd argue that's why it would have been mitigating. It's because it wasn't presented.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions?
All right.
Counsel, thanks so much for your good arguments and good briefs. The court will stand in recess until 11:30.